This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor with Professor H.A. Mackinder. We're touring five capitals in the Eurasian War. There's a war in Europe that spreads all across the world island. Now we have a result from negotiations by the European Union about an oil price gap. The theory is this. You can name the price that everyone must pay to buy Russian seaborne oil, which is the only kind. The Russians don't have a pipeline into Europe for oil, just natural gas. Russian seaborne oil. And if you pay more than that, you will not be provided the insurance that you must have in order to carry oil by sea. And therefore, if you try to avoid this, your insurance company, whoever you deal with, will be sanctioned, and no insurance company can risk losing that business. So that's the theory of how it's going to work. Now, heretofore, we've had reports of Russian oil being sold at $48 a barrel and at $69 a barrel, somewhere moving around in between. The Russians are boasting that they're going to punish anybody who pays the price that Europe is demanding. The Turks have helped some by refusing to grant insurance to any Russian tanker coming out of the Black Sea, no matter who it is. The Russians have offered their own insurance. However, no one's going to accept it, even though that's likely to be very good because the Russians would want to pay off insurance if there's an oil spill. So right now, the oil price cap is in place. What I'm keen on for the professor to observe is this looks like unity in the European Union. Is it, Professor? Is this a sign of better days ahead, or is the European Union as fragmented as ever?
Well, it seems to me that this is a remarkable example of the fact that the European Union can agree on something abstract and all agree on it. $60 is their price. Russia has said that that's unacceptable to them, so the bargain is only half complete. That said, though, the Russians do have an oil pipeline that goes to the Pacific and has a it has a branch that goes to China, but I doubt that our allies in Asia, such as Japan, would actually need to use this Russian oil. And it's a question whether China can afford it and whether she wants to be closely identified with Russia. As for the insurance, almost all of the world's oil is carried by a kind of a collection of somewhat dodgy oil carriers, some of which were built by the Russians, and there's the three countries of Malta, Panama, and Greece that are doing most of it. And I don't think that any of those countries is capable of going up against the sanctions. The question, of course, is this going to be decisive? Is this going to cause people involved in the conflict to change their minds and adopt positions that they would not have in the absence of this oil price cap? And I think the answer there is no. The Russians will still get enough money. The Russians can tighten their belts. And if they so choose, they can keep on drawing down their national capital to fight a pointless war in Ukraine. As we will see, there are other wars and problems beginning to appear in Russia. I should also mention that the Europeans, well, the Turks in particular, they're developing the Caspian Corridor, which makes it possible to take oil from Central Asia down the Caspian Sea through the canal to the Black Sea and then out. So we're gradually getting around this Russian oil problem. And I would say also that the Europeans are pushing very hard for peace. Mr. Macron has been insisting on this in his talks with our leadership. But the problem is that when it comes to the heavy weapons, when it comes to the big money, when it comes to the state-of-the-art anti-aircraft systems, Macron has nothing to offer, even though the security of his country is more threatened by the outcome of the war than is the security of ours. So I'm very pleased. I'm one of these sentimentalists who wants to see Europe become a coherent power. She would be a very, very positive player in the world system. She's got more money. She's got more land. She's got at least as much know-how as we do, but she's short on what we refer to as people in uniforms.
Professor H.J. Macander, International Relations, commenting on five capitals. Congratulations to the EU and Ms. van der Leyen and the other negotiators, because right up to the end, it did not look like there was going to be success. Poland was the last one to give permission. Poland wanted a much lower price to give permission. However, there'll be more tests of the European Union ahead, because it's always been the vulnerability of the war in Ukraine that Russia would find someone in the European Union to say no, and all decisions must be made unanimously. Now we go to United States, Washington, D.C., and recently remarks by the president are suggestive of negotiations. Professor H.J. Macander, this is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor with Professor H.J. Macander, International Relations, commenting on five capitals. We arrive at Washington, D.C. After the midterm election, it's quiet. The lame duck Congress is in place for an omnibus bill and other debates, but the big decisions will be made after the year in the new Congress. However, Washington has foreign policy that's been enhanced these last days by a state dinner for the president of France, Mr. Macron, and for words of loyalty conveyed from the U.S. to France and from France to the U.S. That, however, is not as important as what we saw was an indication that Joe Biden is in some fashion sending a message to Vladimir Putin that he's not yet ready to talk. Now, that in itself is a message, you're talking. The way the headline reads, Biden not planning to speak to Putin for now. Professor, we've been waiting for this because we've read our diplomatic history. The way you end a war is with diplomacy, and diplomacy begins by people refusing to talk. How far along is the not talking, and are we reaching a point where counselors must speak for the presidents and looking for a big peace treaty ahead?
Well, the first point I'd make is to modify what you said slightly, which is that wars don't end by negotiations and peace treaties. Wars end by military victories, whether total or partial, which are sufficient to convince whoever it is who has lost in this large military defeat that they'd better talk. And absent some kind of a major defeat like that, talks with Russia will go on well into the next decade or the next century. I mention this because I don't think that Washington understands this, that the best thing they could do to end this war fast would to be sure that the Ukrainians are getting the relatively small number of other weapons that they need to fill out their panoply of weapons and enable them simply to drive the Russians out. That the Russians came in uninvited, well, there's no reason why the Ukrainians should not push them out. That, after all, is we're talking about boundaries that are defined and recognized by the UN, and that have been defined and recognized by the United States and Russia. But I fear that in Washington, people are still very much passive. We're living imagining that the return of stability to Central Europe is going to mean going back to sort of more or less the way it was before. And it reminds me very much of the tragic 30s. Of course, after the Rhineland, really, it had already tipped. It was clear that Germany was going to war. But in 1937 and 1938, Britain, which had rendered herself an unconvincing partner in negotiations by vast military cuts following World War I, the British diplomats and the French diplomats, who mostly just said no, focused on really microscopic issues of the Germans and the Czechs in former Bohemian Moravia, which since 1919 had been called Czechoslovakia. And the League of Nations and Versailles had seen to it that the historical boundaries of Bohemia and Moravia were maintained when the new state of Czechoslovakia was created. In other words, the German populations were not sort of carved off the margins, which they could have been, and incorporated into Germany. Rather, there was an idea that somehow there should be a Czechoslovakia, which, as was improbably stated, would be like Switzerland. This was unrealistic dwelling on material which was not about the main thing. The main thing was that the British, and also the French to some extent, had no real sense of Hitler's real plan, of Hitler's actual plans for his Reich. And I think we have the same problem in imputing a degree of rationality to Russian policymaking, as we did to Soviet policymaking before it, and as we do to Chinese policymaking, which is simply not warranted by the history of their policy making. What we need is not not detailed maps of where the different nationalities are located, or how you might be able to dice up the Ukraine so that everybody was happy, which I think is completely impossible. What we need is a comprehensive vision of the real future. And this real future, as I go on every week, is going to involve a fundamental reconstitution of the political order and the political balances and the economic balances in Eurasia, which is immense. We're guided by the long dead candle of a belief in Cold War revisionism. But let's look at some of the other states. They're going to have to be involved. The one that everybody's looking at is China. It seems that even though China is in complete chaos, we can't keep Mr. Marcel from going there, and Mr. Blinken's probably got another phone call booked, but they're in no position to do anything. So I would say that Washington is displaying a lamentable lack of a sense of the scale of the issues that they're going to have to face. And they should, instead of playing games like saying, we'll talk to Putin, but maybe not now, we should be talking to lots of other countries, and our best people should be thinking seriously about all of Eurasia, 6,000 miles from Calais to Vladivostok. We're not doing that.
And, Professor, the meeting between the heads of the two security agencies, Mr. Burns for the United States, that took place outside of the United States, outside of Russia in these last weeks, is that significant, or is that routine matter of deconflicting, they call it?
Well, I don't see how you can deconflict this. This is a conflict. Ukraine was invaded by a foreign power that recognized Ukraine as an independent state. Mr. Burns is one of our most competent diplomats, although whether he is able to clean the Aegean stables of the CIA remains to be seen. But I think what we should look at is just a little of the other states that Peking, China among them, that are going to have to be in on the final act.
Professor H.J. Mackinder, International Relations. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. We're headed to Beijing. I'm John Batchelor.